I wouldn't say we fell in love right away. I think we were, as they call it in the biz, trauma bonding.
And then after 8 years of being insufferably sober, I started drinking again.
Addicts tend to be rather sensitive people.
Aren't you Marc Maron? I'm like, yeah. And she goes, what happened to you?
Hi, you're listening to Recover Girl. It's a podcast all about addiction and recovery. And increasingly, it's about creativity. If you're new to the show, welcome. You can get this podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, all of those places. If you listen and you are not a subscriber, why not subscribe? It helps me and it helps you. You can also review and rate it. And if you want to find out more about this podcast, go to recovergirlpod.com. That's all I've got. Oh, did I say I'm your host, Anna David? I can't even remember, but and it was a second ago. Sorry, my brain's fried. I'm sitting here with a wonderful guest, and his name's Dave Smith.
Hey, Anna.
And so I know Dave. He is a longtime teacher of Buddhism. He is an author. I got to know him because he was teaching at Against the Stream. And he's wonderful. And one night when I came to hear you talk, he would give Dharma talks. I mean, he still gives Dharma talks, but he gave a Dharma talk and then he leads a meditation. And I was going through it and crying. Do you remember this? And I went up to you.
I do remember that, yeah.
And I was like, you changed my life.
Oh, I always get so nervous when people say that.
Wait, and do you remember this was great alcoholism. I hope I'm not outing you as someone who has negative self-talk. You go, I thought I suck.
Yeah, I've had those nights. Many times I do.
And I was like, but you changed my life. It was so profound. And you didn't believe me. You're like, no, I sucked tonight.
I felt that way, yeah. It's interesting when you teach all the time and you're in front of the room and you're talking that sometimes it's hard work to do sometimes. And when you're teaching all the time, you're not sure if the material you're talking about is landing for people. And a lot of times that will happen is I'll think that I did a terrible job and somebody will come up and tell me, no, that was really great, changed my life.
Yeah.
And then there'll be times where I'll give a talk and I'll think to myself, that was so amazing. And then I'll listen to it later and be like, that actually wasn't good at all. That was really bad.
Do you listen to them always?
You know, I don't always listen to them. I don't like listening to myself talk. But years ago when I started teaching, just in a public speaking way, it's actually really quite good to listen to yourself talk because you can make adjustments and you can make changes that are needed. So as much as I don't like it, it feels a little weird to listen to myself give a Dharma talk. I don't listen to all my talks, but I listen to quite a few of them, especially if I'm giving a new talk on new material, mm-hmm. because I want to see how I did and I want to see what I need to change next time. So I've taken that burden on of listening to my talks for the purpose of actually giving them giving better ones next time.
I think that's great. I sort of vacillate between doing that and not. I used to listen to all of them with the thinking, my rationalization was I need to make sure that the intro and the outro were put on perfectly, but I think I wanted to hear them. And my best story about it is one time I was pulled over at a sobriety checkpoint and I said, not only am I not drunk, I'm an actual sober person and I'm listening to my own podcast about recovery. And the cop looks at me and he goes, that's a little much.
That is a little much.
Awesome though. But now I don't listen anymore because I just get tired of hearing my voice, you know?
Yeah. I listen less and less now because I've kind of improved on all of the stuff I used to do. Like I used to talk too fast or I would say too much or these kind of public speaking things. I've kind of fixed a lot of that. But if I do give a talk on material that's new for me, I will oftentimes listen to that particular talk so I can make improvements for the next time.
When you give a Dharma talk, so those aren't always new? The ones I would go to, were they always felt very fresh. Are they recycled talks?
Well, kind of. I mean, to some degree, I'm one of those people who memorizes really quite well.
Yeah.
And I used to be in bands and I know song lyrics and I'm kind of a jukebox. I can get up and play probably 100 songs. So I'm good at memorizing. So I've memorized much of the Buddhist teachings and I've memorized a lot of the material that I like and I want to regurgitate. So, you know, you might see that I give two talks on, say, right view. Mm-hmm. And there might be a lot of similarities, but there will also be a lot of differences. So what I'll usually do in my mind, if I'm not totally prepared, is I'll have sort of 5 bullet points.
Yeah.
This is where I want to start. This is where I want to go. this is some of the things I want to cover, and this is where I want to end. So I might, if I had notes, I might only have 5 bullet points written on a page. So I do try to map them out a little bit, and some things will be repetitive, and some things will be fresh, and some things will be totally spontaneous.
See, that's perfect, because if it was a fully memorized talk, it's not going to have that life-changing, organic thing. And it's sort of in 12-step rooms, you know, quote-unquote circuit speakers, sometimes, you know, oftentimes they're my least favorite because it's so canned.
They're so canned and it's so well rehearsed that it's obvious, and it loses its authenticity, which is a bummer, because that's one of the things about 12-step sharing and story that I think is what makes people feel so connected, is when they have the experience of somebody giving an authentic message that feels not rehearsed and feels real and feels spontaneous. So
yeah.
And I think that people in recovery have really good bullshit detectors anyway.
Yeah, I remember this one that I went to. It was at a convention, and the speaker did a cry, a mid-share cry, and then it was a bit, it turned out, and he really wasn't crying. And I was, you know, and then he revealed 2 minutes later that it was a fake cry. And I was just like, now we can't trust a word you said. You
That's
just
right.
showed us you're an actor.
That's right.
So speaking of 12, so how long have you been sober?
14 years, just a few days ago.
Awesome. Oh, that's right. The day you were supposed to come
do
this.
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And what got you sober?
Suffering and more suffering.
Yep.
But, you know, for me, it was, you know, I have I'll say some unpopular things about it for the most part, is that I would say 80% of my drinking and using was fabulous. I had a wonderful time. I got away with murder. It worked for me for a long, long periods of time. And I actually don't regret a lot of the stuff that happened in my active using. Now, it got really, really bad towards the end.
Right.
And so I would say probably the last 2 years, maybe 3 years, was really, really, really bad. And I'm very fortunate. I'm one of those people. I have one white chip. I only tried one time. I knew, you know, that I needed to stop drinking and using drugs. I knew that when it was time to do that, you went to this place called AA.
Right.
And, you know, and I sort of knew that that was coming. And I had been in my teen years. So it wasn't that hard for me. So I just sort of went in and, you know, have remained sober 14 years since my first meeting.
I don't think the statistic, the percentage is that off for most people. I think 80-20. I mean, I've never heard someone say that, and I like it. But yeah, I mean, the reason the 20% got so bad is that it worked so well for so long.
That's right.
So why had you gone as a teenager then?
Well, you know, I was, I had a lot of trauma as a teenager, and I was drinking fairly regularly at the age of 10 and 11.
So how were you even get? You were stealing it from your parents?
Well, my father had a refrigerator in the basement that had, you know, 70 Budweisers in it. So I could take 8 or 9 of them, and they would never notice. I grew up in that, you know, New England. My dad was a Vietnam vet, construction, beer drinking. I thought everybody drank 15 beers every day.
Right.
So I grew up around that. So there was nothing unnormal about that. And so because of that, there was a teacher in my school who was an Al-Anon woman and who knew a lot about AA, and she used to take kids to Alateen.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember Alateen.
Yeah.
Children. So I used to go to Alateen and think it was strange because my family wasn't really that dysfunctional. My father drank all the time, but he didn't hit us. He wasn't abusive. It was just sort of like, yeah, my dad gets drunk a lot. What's the problem?
Yeah.
But then we would once in a while go, instead of going to Alateen, we would actually go to AA meetings. And so then a couple years later in high school, I threw up at a school dance. And got in with hammered out of my face. And like, so they had me go. I sort of got sentenced, if you will, as a teenager to AA. And I'd go to AA and not hear the end of the story. People would tell these awesome stories about drinking and doing drugs. And I'd be like, yeah, what's the problem? I totally want to do all those things.
Right. And then you would just tune out the end?
I would just tune out the end, apparently.
Wow. Now, question. First of all, what an amazing teacher that she would do that. Don't
you
think?
Yeah, that was great, yes. In fact, I still have the first big book she gave me probably 25, maybe 30 years ago now at my parents' house that has a little kind of, I hope this someday will be helpful, transcription in it, which is kind of...
Were you annoyed at the time?
Not really, no, actually. I always thought AA was cool. I just didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to get in the way of my drinking.
Right. So it didn't occur to you back then that you had a problem?
No, definitely not.
And so then what was your, can we talk about your trauma?
Well, trauma for me was mostly, so if you look at it, I have what's called episodic So I have episodes of traumatic loss. So I had a sister who was killed in a car accident when I was 11 years old, mm-hmm. who was like my best friend, and I looked up to her. And so she was tragically killed in a car accident. And when I was 19, me and my girlfriend at the time got hit by a drunk driver, and she was killed. And I was there to witness that whole accident, which was really, really, really traumatic for me, because it was like we got hit by a car and I had to discover the dead body and go to the police station and get the ambulance and ID the driver of the car. And then so that was probably the one that had the biggest charge. I actually think getting sober is traumatic, so I count that as one of mine, because I had to quit. I quit my band. I was in a very successful band and touring and living in Amsterdam at the time, so I had to give up my whole rock and roll career to get sober. And then 5 years into sobriety, I got married, and my wife, we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and she relapsed and started drinking and actually ended up getting murdered about 5 years after that.
Oh my God.
Which was actually big news in Nashville. It was like on the paper and the news. So for most of my trauma has been around catastrophic death and loss.
What about your motorcycle accident? Do you count that?
You know, I probably should, but I don't feel like I picked up any new traumatic stress symptoms as a result of that accident. It was more of a bodily trauma, I think. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was in the trauma unit for sure. They had to screw my pelvis back together. But I don't feel any symptomatic results of having been in that accident, although it was certainly traumatic.
Was it about a year ago?
No, it was October 15th, so 9 months.
You know, want to know something bizarre? Josh was supposed to come and record a podcast with me, texted me, and was like, Dave was just in a horrible accident and had to cancel.
Yeah.
And you were in the hospital for...
I was in the hospital for about probably 6 weeks.
Jesus. Mm-hmm. And did they put you on pain pills?
I was heavily sedated in the hospital. I mean, I had an open book fracture on my pelvis, so I was on like insane amounts of Dilaudid. And, you know, I don't remember, to be honest with you, I don't really remember much of being in the hospital.
The entire 6 weeks?
Yeah, most of it I don't remember, which I'm happy about. Mm-hmm. And when I left the hospital, I didn't leave on any pain medication, so I didn't take any pain medication at all post discharge from the hospital. And I haven't had really a whole lot of pain. I certainly don't have any chronic pain as a result of the motorcycle accident. So, you know, I didn't have any sort of fear or any experience of detox or withdrawal that seemed to be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ed, it's interesting how much car accidents have featured so prominently in your life.
It's true.
That's just bizarre.
Yeah, I try not to make up stories about that kind
of
stuff because it's easy to do. But it has been thematic, you know. It's been a reoccurring, catastrophic event. But then again, if we look at the statistic, car accidents, motorcycle accidents are very common. So it wasn't like, you know, that strange of a scenario. But it has been definitely a reoccurring theme of like these traumatic events where somebody dies.
Yeah.
And of course, the most recent one, the person who almost died was me.
Yeah.
So that's the first time I was actually in that predicament. Usually it's somebody else close to me that I really care about, you know, is alive one day and they're gone the next day. And so that kind of traumatic loss is, you know, really not something that people manage well.
Now, how does your trauma manifest itself today?
Well, I mostly feel pretty resolved. I've done lots and lots of trauma therapy, everything from EMDR to Gestalt part works, a lot of experiential work that I did when I was in Nashville, Tennessee with Dr. Lee Norton. And now I do work with this person in Los Angeles, which is more of a Gestalt type of therapy. So I do experience traumatic stress symptoms for sure. And for me, it tends to be in the arena of hypervigilance, of really, really, really tuning in and focusing on those things. A lot of unrealistic fear about things, and for me a sense of urgency where I might be like hatching a type of escape plan of like, I need to get the fuck out of here, this place isn't safe, I gotta go. But the episodes are very short now because I have so much awareness of them that if I'm in sort of a PTS state, I usually can say, oh, I'm in a PTS state, I need to completely ignore all the information I'm getting from my mind, and I have resources that I can use to get through the episode with, usually without having to do or say anything that is destructive.
Breathing is one of the tools?
Breathing I do, but yeah, breathing. I mean, body-based practices, of course. And for me, the big one, of course, is to recognize that my perception in any type of heightened traumatic state, what happens is your perception becomes extremely altered. So all the information that you're getting from your mind, all of the data you're getting in that present time experience is usually very, very faulty.
Right.
So you have to become aware of that, and you have to recognize that there's certain stories and certain themes that information in your mind is telling you, I'm not safe, this isn't okay, they're out to get me. It's, you know, whatever the story is for you. So that way when my thinking takes on that kind of proliferation, I take that as a warning sign of like, okay, like I need to actually not trust any of the data I'm getting right now until this episode is over.
How long can the episode last?
Anywhere from, you know, 2 hours to 2 weeks for me. I don't have the long ones anymore. One of our good friends, I'm sure you knew Curtis Washington.
I didn't, but
oh, you didn't? Okay.
No.
Anyway, he's a good friend of ours who worked with us, and he was part of Against the Stream, was killed in a tragic motorcycle accident. And I experienced latent symptoms. So he was killed in a car accident. I didn't start to experience symptoms till about 10 days or 2 weeks later. And I experienced symptoms for fairly heightened symptoms that were pretty hard to manage for about 10 days to 2 weeks.
The heightened symptoms being your thoughts, I'm not okay.
I'm not okay. It's not okay. The world is unsafe. People are not trustworthy. I need to get out of here. Kind of a hyper arousal, very, very distressed state, knowing that I'm distressed yeah. while being distressed, but not being able to do anything about
yep.
it except for basically tolerate it.
Yeah.
Because
and not act on it.
Yeah. And that's the key, of course, having an addiction is to not do anything, not engage in any destructive behavior to medicate the distressed state.
Yeah. And also it's like, so you're in a relationship. So let's say you're going through this for 2 weeks. What are you saying to your girlfriend? Like, are you like, hey, look, honey, I'm in it right now.
That's right.
Don't trust anything I say.
That's right. Well, at the time, fortunately or unfortunately, I was single and I yeah. wasn't in a relationship. So,
but when it happens now,
it hasn't happened since too much for me. But usually, what it is, it's yeah, hey, just so you know, I'm kind of cuckoo right now, you know, and I might need additional support so it's just kind of being honest about it when it happens.
But also you have to go and be this quote unquote spiritual guy yeah. giving Dharma talks. What happens if you're in one of those states?
You know, it's hard. It
yeah.
can be hard. You can be like an attitude of, I don't really want to do this right now.
Yeah.
But one thing that I've been able to do histrionically around trauma is I've actually, one of the byproducts of being a meditator is I learned how to do this thing that sometimes is called spiritual bypassing, where I've actually learned to some degree how to repress
yep.
emotional states when they're present so I can actually get through the day,
yep.
which is actually really, really useful and also very, very problematic.
If you can put it on hold and go, okay, I'm going to take care of this later.
Yeah. So I've learned how to do that. So when yeah. I go into a situation where I might have a heightened state of traumatic stress, I can kind of shut it down in the short term to kind of get through the Dharma talk or get through the experience. And sometimes I'll actually incorporate it into the talk
yeah.
if it feels appropriate. And sometimes I'll actually intentionally repress it for a period of time and just pull off my cognitive function of being like, okay, I know what I'm going to talk about. I know this material. I can kind of speak from more from my head than from my heart. So if I feel I'm in a highly emotional state, I probably won't teach something that is going to trigger that. I might
yeah.
teach something that's a little bit more of a wisdom practice or more educational or more didactic. So, you know, to some degree, I do what I have to do to take care of myself in that experience so I don't get blown out.
And what's interesting to me about this is the state that you describe is certainly not very different from what is considered quote unquote alcoholism or alcoholic thinking. I mean, that is
true.
You know, that's something I relate to it. So I have some PTSD, but I relate to it in terms of alcoholic thinking. Just any time that I am sad and there's nothing to be sad about, I go to my thinking and I go, you know, what are these thoughts that are triggering
Yeah.
And then I just have to go, well, okay, that's not real. And it's a constant process of walking it back.
That's
you
right.
have the thought, you walk it back. Great work. But the thought just came back.
That's right. Well, I think what we would call mental obsession. is that we oftentimes get in these states or these experiences where we're more mentally obsessed with basically either controlling something or fixing something or figuring something out or even maybe trying to solve a problem that's actually not happening right now, which is really, really stressful. So I think a lot of times it's just, you know, from an awareness-based practice, which is basically where I come from nowadays, is you have to recognize when that's happening to even begin to do anything about it.
Yeah. And it's, and you know, I think you said it really well when it's like, just because you know it's happening doesn't make it go away.
That's right.
That's the rub.
Sometimes it makes it worse.
Yeah. Because then you can blame yourself, you mean, almost?
You can blame yourself, or you can, there's a variety of things that can happen. But I think one of the things that happens is that we think that just because I'm aware of it, that means it should go away.
Right.
And so that way we kind of either choose to believe it as being this person who has this problem. I'm this person who has this problem. I always have this problem. Why do I have this problem? What do I do about this problem? Or we practice with it and say, okay, this is a very familiar pattern or habit,
right,
psychological habit that gets me.
Right.
Am I going to work with this, or am I going to kind of collapse into it?
Right. I think, you know, if one believes that, you know, as I do sort of, I do believe that alcoholism is less about how much we drink and do drugs and all of that stuff, and more about that feeling of, I can't handle how I feel right now. I'll do anything I possibly can to change it.
Sure.
You know, and that's how, you know, some people don't get why you have to keep treating alcoholism even when the obsession to drink and use has gone away. And it's like, well, because that thinking is still there.
That's right. Yeah. Any type of experience that we get into, and usually the ones that are most distressing are of an emotional variety.
Sure.
Which is why I love the emotional sobriety stuff that came much, much later. It's that, you know, like, if we don't have the capacity to manage difficult emotions, we'll do something to medicate those difficult emotions.
Right.
And
right,
there's a lot of ways you can do that. It could be, you know, Uber Eats and Netflix, or right, it could be hit the crack pipe.
Right.
So there's a wide range of ways in which we medicate those experiences. And ultimately, if we can manage the experience, we don't have to reach for the medication. And for me, that's what recovery is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. You got me distracted with Uber Eats and Netflix. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's like the process, so that one doesn't sort of quote act alcoholically in sobriety, is learning to tolerate the emotions. You don't get to a place of, I can't tolerate how I feel, I'll do anything I can to escape it.
Exactly. You eradicate the cause instead of reducing or alleviating the symptom,
right,
which is how Western medicine and how a lot of these things work. Is that, that's why I like Buddhism so much, is that Buddhism isn't about alleviating or medicating or reducing symptoms. It's about actually eradicating the cause of it in the first place.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think is a very encouraging idea.
I remembered and then I forgot again. My God, I can't believe. Oh, okay. So, because I was like, oh, I gotta ask him that, and then something else popped in. So, how did you start studying Buddhism?
You know, again, it was born out of traumatic stress. It was born out of sort of basically like, as that my girlfriend got killed in that car accident when I was 19. I was very fortunate that one of the kids I grew up with, his parents were friends with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and a lot of these IMS sort of Dharma teachers, the first wave of the mindfulness generation.
What's IMS?
Insight Meditation Society, okay, which is a Buddhist retreat center in Massachusetts.
It's okay.
Spirit Rock, IMS. They kind of the first places where people went and did these long-term mindfulness retreats. So I met a Buddhist teacher at 19 and sat down with him, and he basically explained to me the Buddhist perspective or paradigm, although I didn't know that's what he was doing, where he just normalized suffering.
Mm.
And I told him about the loss and the hardship and the heartbreak and the death and having to see all of that. And he, you know, basically put it in the framework of like, yeah, that's how it is here. This is how life is for everybody.
Right.
And that you actually are seeing it clearly now, and your heart kind of got ripped open to the reality of experience, and there's actually this you have some agency over that. And so that Buddhism acknowledges suffering as being part of life, and it also acknowledges that there's a way in which we can put an end to all of the unnecessary suffering that we engage in.
Right.
And so that's usually a pretty attractive idea to most people.
Now, this idea that you got to be awakened to what reality is, what about those people who never get that awakening, those lucky bastards?
Yeah, I know. It's one of those things. Is it a blessing or a curse? I think everybody that you talk to, and I talk to people, and I try to remove my Buddhist lexicon and talk to the humanity of people, because I think that that's the language that people speak, is trying to let people know that people pretty much can identify that they suffer in ways that seem to be fairly unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people can diagnose themselves pretty quickly. You're probably doing it right now.
Oh, I didn't need to do it right now. I do it all day long. Right. Yeah.
So if we start to understand that we do suffer in ways that appear to be unnecessary,
yeah,
we could also understand that there's things that we could do to eradicate that whole process. Now, of course, we might alleviate the symptoms or reduce that in the short term, but the idea that we could stop suffering in unnecessary ways is usually what inspires people to begin to practice something like meditation.
Right.
Because that's not a very difficult idea to kind of get behind.
Yeah. Yeah. But still I wonder about those people who don't, you know, kind of more shallow people who don't seem to ever experience, who don't, you know, who don't buy the self-help books, who don't seek meditation. Right. And who don't seem to suffer with alcoholism and mental illness.
Well, there are certainly well-adjusted people who seem to do just fine about life. And
yeah.
I'm just not one of those people. And I'm not actually that interested in those people for the most part. You know, what do we call them? Normies around here? Is that what you guys call them out here?
I guess that's what we call them.
Yeah, it's so boring.
I give anything to be one of them. But anyway, so in terms of, so you first were exposed to Buddhism at 19. Did you start practicing Buddhism then?
Yeah, I mean, from 19 to 28, I both played in bands, did copious amounts of drugs and alcohol and a lot of the behaviors that come with that, and was sitting meditation retreats. I would go sit 10-day retreats, 5-day retreats. I would sit daily at times. I would do day-longs. I considered myself somebody who did practice Dharma, but I also drank. So I was like sort of a barstool Buddhist, I used to say.
Right, right.
And so I did both for a long period of time and was very conflicted by that. But because alcohol worked so well for me and I enjoyed the lifestyle so much, I wasn't willing to give that up.
Right.
So I kind of did this, you know, double life thing, right, that we talk about so much, of like being this person who was influenced by Buddhism and had a pretty big reverence for Dharma practice, as seeing it as being a really true, authentic way to live. But because I was having so much fun and so much success engaging in drugs, alcohol, and rock and roll, until the suffering of that became so great, I just wasn't able to really give that up.
What was your band?
The band called Jaya the Cat.
Okay.
Terrible band name. The band is still around. They're still in Amsterdam. They still put out records. From what I can tell, they're still doing what they've ever been doing. And we didn't do well in the States. We were pretty successful in Europe. We were kind of a ska punk reggae party band, kind of Sublime meets Rancid.
Mm-hmm.
And
what'd you play?
I played guitar, lead guitar, and I sang maybe 30% of the songs and wrote some of the songs. And we're just a big, big party band, and with a lot of fun for a long period of time until it wasn't.
And did you think that you could possibly still be in a band once you were sober?
I've been in several bands since I've been sober. And actually, for me, probably one of the biggest disappointments that I continue to struggle with day to day is, especially now being 42 years old and the status of the music world, is that I'm pretty much have, you know, come to the realization that I'm never going to have a successful music career. And that actually bothers me. You know, I love music. I love performing. I love writing. But I've kind of had to hang that one out to dry. And I do still carry with myself a pretty big degree of disappointment about not having been able to make that work sober.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recorded a bunch of records and I've been in some fairly successful bands. I spent 7 years in Nashville where I was playing music and teaching Buddhism. But it just, at one point, I just realized this just isn't going to happen.
You never do know.
You never know.
I mean, if...
I mean, I'm open, but I'm also, you know, aware that it's probably unlikely.
You know, if J.K. Rowling had said that on her, you know, 13th rejection or 130th rejection of Harry Potter, we would not have Harry Potter.
And I also am not putting much effort into it, too, so that's part of it. So I've kind of resigned to music is something that I love. I listen to it all the time. I play it when I feel like it, but I'm not trying to... There's a lot of suffering in that striving of trying to make that work.
Well, yeah, and your success there led you to, you know, near death.
Right.
So there are some things that are more important than maybe having that kind of dream come true.
That's right. And that's sort of where I've landed now. It's like, you know, so it would be inauthentic of me to say, oh, I don't care about that. I'm over it. Yeah. That would not be true. It's like, yeah. I am a little bit disappointed, but I also, you know, I'm okay with that.
Right. Now, in terms of other creative ventures, let's talk about your book.
Yeah. Well, I wrote this book called Ethical Mindfulness maybe like 3 years ago now. And it's an ebook. You can get it, you know, on Amazon and any
but
of those places.
But hold on. I saw a printed out copy. That's what
well,
I'm telling
you. Well, the publisher
you.
Did print some copies for promotional reasons. So okay. You might have seen yeah. those around at addiction treatment conferences. So yeah. there are. And I think I have, you know, I think I have 10 or 15 of them at my house. So they yeah. did print some up for that. But it was an ebook format. And the reason I wrote that book was because of the fact that we have these kind of emerging problems of there's Buddhist mindfulness and mindfulness comes from the Buddhist tradition, but also we see things that mindfulness has become very popular in the secular world.
Yes.
So there's mindfulness-based stress reduction. We see it all over in addiction treatment and mental health. And on the cover of Newsweek magazine, it's become a very secular part of modern mental health.
Yeah.
So I thought what I wanted to do was to try to find a middle way between those two mm-hmm. of saying, how can we honor the Buddhist tradition and practice mindfulness in a secular way? And my big play on that was sort of A, trying to merge secular emotional intelligence therapeutic modalities with, in Buddhism, what we call heart practice meditation or Brahma Viharas, or what I really like to just call the sort of beautiful spiritual emotions that we have access to. So kindness, loving kindness, mm-hmm. compassion, gratitude, forgiveness, mm-hmm. and equanimity, of trying to incorporate into meditation practice ethical, what I use the word ethical, which I'm, you know, with sort of the word I landed on as being a word that people are familiar with, but in the Buddhist context, ethical just meaning non-harming. Mm-hmm. So how do we, if we want to practice mindfulness and we want to have happy lives, the argument is that we actually can't cause harm. Mm-hmm. So we have to live in a way where we're not causing suffering to ourselves or to others mm-hmm. and trying to include that into mindfulness, secular practices. And of course, working in the addiction treatment field so much that I've done, I've noticed that people who suffer from addiction tend to need some emotional support mm-hmm. and that a lot of times basic mindfulness practices are not very effective for people with addiction, especially in the early stages, because of the shame and the guilt and the self-hatred is so high that they really need to begin to practice kindness for themselves mm-hmm. and compassion for their suffering, probably right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so that was what I noticed in the work that I did working in the Deep South and prisons and youth detention centers, was that mindfulness wasn't effective unless it was accompanied by attitudes of non-harming. Mm-hmm. And so the book came out of that perspective and that work that I did.
And what was your process for writing it?
It was very interesting. I'm actually really looking forward to writing another book because I think I learned a lot about writing as a result of that. So basically what I did is, because I don't have a college degree, I'm not a colloquial learned person, I don't have any degrees, and I'm kind of, you know, basically like a punk rock kid from Boston who barely graduated high school, I wrote above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to come across as appearing very smart. Mm-hmm. So the first manuscript I sent to the publisher, they're like, dude, this is way too dense.
Academic, yeah.
Way too academic, way too dense. Like, so I had to they basically said, cut it in half, take out some of this needing to be smart shit and just deliver it as if your mom was reading it. Mm. So I did that and did a fairly good job. But now I feel like, having been through that process one time, I feel like I can write in a way that wouldn't be any different than how I'm talking to you right now, which I think is what good writing is all about. So I'm looking forward to writing another book. And I've sent out some proposals on it. So I've been kind of in some negotiations about what that might look like.
What's fascinating is you just gave my writing lecture, which is basically, this is what I teach, is that school, bless its heart, taught us some great things. English classes, I think, taught us some great things about analysis and literature. What it did not teach us is how to write, because my best writers, so I have this coaching program for writers, blah, blah, blah. The best writers are the ones who write the way they sound. My favorite compliment people give me when they read one of my books is, felt like hanging out with you.
That's right. And that's how I feel. I mean, that's how I like to read.
Totally.
You know,
do you have favorite authors?
I do have some favorite authors, although I mostly read these like really dry academic Buddhist books, unfortunately.
Right.
But you know, I mean, I grew up reading like Charles Bukowski,
right.
Which definitely,
yeah, not academic.
You know, I like a lot of the existential prose. I like Albert Camus. I like his novels.
Mm-hmm.
Because of music, I'm more interested in like song lyrics. I don't really like poetry, which is interesting, but I like songs. I like lyrical type of writing. I think that writing a song is a really, really interesting craft.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as authors go, I'm not a big avid reader, and most of the stuff I read in the last really decade has been
Buddhist literature
and Buddhist psychology and Buddhist teachings, which is not fun to read at all. It's just like...
It's part of the job,
exactly. It's like reading a VCR manual. Like, nobody wants to read that shit, you know?
Well, it's interesting because I tried, like, I have Buddha's brain sitting right there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I heard Mary talk about it, and she just made it so accessible. Have you read Buddha's brain?
I have not.
And I was just like, I'm going to read this. Oh, my God. 3 pages in, I was so bored.
That's right. Yeah, I don't read. I never really was a person who read for entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So reading is more about learning and trying to absorb material. So I can go at sort of that dry material a little bit better than other people because I'm not actually trying to be entertained.
Right, right.
I'm just trying to understand the concepts and ideas that are being expressed.
Yeah, and like you said, you have a really good memory.
I do have a really good memory.
Mine is so different. I read purely for entertainment. And so if I'm not entertained at every second, I don't finish the book.
Exactly.
But in terms of your process with writing, so did you write 3 pages a day? How long is the book?
It was 170 pages. Then it was cut in half to like whatever half of that is, 80 or 90. And then I think it's 70 now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 70. So it's like, well, it was one of those things where every word needed to be relevant.
Right.
So actually, I'm pretty happy with the project because it was edited so much that if any sentence didn't need to be there, it had to come out.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of material packed into 70 pages. But, you know, people who are interested in kind of an introduction to mindfulness, who are interested in Buddhism, and also people who aren't interested in Buddhism, it kind of speaks to that middle of the road person. So I think it's a good kind of mindfulness 101 book that people can kind of digest in 70 pages and at least get them. It's loaded with a lot of useful information.
In terms of, you know, having to have every word count, there's this famous quote, William Carlos Williams, maybe? I can't remember. Where it's a writer who said, I was going to write you a short note, but I didn't have time, so I wrote you this long letter instead. Because
right.
It actually takes so much longer
to
edit and
condense
and make every word count.
And that's how I, you know, coming from a songwriting background, you know, you have to make the words fit with a cadence and rhythm. It's like more like writing a crossword puzzle.
Right.
You know, rather than just like writing. So one thing that was fun for me about writing was when I started writing prose, I was able to just write.
Yeah,
I didn't have to make it fit into meter, into diction, into rhyming. So it was a little bit, I kind of felt like I was off the leash a little bit.
It's interesting because I used to try to write screenplays and TV scripts. And they always felt so much like a math problem to me.
That's right. That makes sense. Yeah.
And so the freedom of just being able, I couldn't believe it when I wrote my first novel. I was just like, wait, I just get to do this. And all I have to do is follow a 3-act structure. And you kind of don't even have to do that.
Yeah.
It was so liberating. So what is your next book going to be about?
Well, you know, it's hard to get a book deal nowadays.
It sure is.
One of the things that's been frustrating for me is a couple publishers have come to me, approached me about writing a book. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And then they're like, well, send us a proposal. And then they're like, well, we're not sure. I'm like, well, you actually came to me.
Right, right.
So I feel like nowadays what they want is they actually want you to write the whole fucking book and then decide whether they want it. And I just don't have the time or the energy to write a whole book as a maybe. But I do want to write this. 2 books I want to write. One is I'm working with this woman, Eve Ekman, who's an emotional researcher.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about writing a book called Evolution or Revolution, which would be Emotional Intelligence Meets Buddhist Psychology, which is a workshop we've done a bunch of times. So we're trying to work that out, which is hard because it's collaborative. But I actually want to write an autobiography called The Wound That Seeks the Arrow.
Oh, well, that was the lecture that you gave that changed my life.
Okay, that's right. That's what I, and I thought that talk totally sucked. And it's on the podcast now. I got to listen to it to see if it's true. It was a teaching I heard from Ajahn Sachito. And I think that what happens, and I love this idea of a wound that seeks an arrow.
Yeah.
Because the first thing we think is, well, why would a wound seek an arrow?
Right.
But how are the ways, and my life has definitely been plagued by the theme of me, some part of my woundedness, which I have not totally resolved. I don't think anybody really has. But how is my woundedness and my inner struggle, how do I seek external situations and relationships and situations that I'm constantly unconsciously rewounding myself?
Right, right. One thing that I did want to say about what you said about what publishers want, they still want book proposals, but they want full book proposals. They want, you know, 25 to 50 pages of, this is my overview, this is my sample
chapter. I've done those.
You have.
I have, and I've still gotten, we want to see more. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm not giving you more. And I'm like, and I'm busy. And like, for me, one of the things that hasn't motivated me is I don't get the ego stroke of, right, like having written a book. Like, for me, having done the ebook, one thing I recognize is writing a book is hard work.
Yeah.
And like, you know, so I don't feel that sense of an urgency of, I need to write a book and I need to get a book out there. So I feel a little maybe lazy about it. So I kind of feel like until somebody really, really wants to do it. And I have a couple publishing houses that are talking about it. And of course, autobiographies and memoirs are the hardest things to get published nowadays, which is kind of on a therapeutic level for me. It's the book I'm most interested in writing right now.
My experience, because I talk to publishers and agents like all day long. I'm doing two new books right now. They're not the hardest. I think they're the easiest. The hardest thing to sell right now are novels.
Maybe you and I should talk after this podcast.
But yeah, no, I mean, and in my coaching program, I walk 10 writers through. This is how you write a proposal. This is how you sell it. This is, and then one of the way that it works is one of the 10 gets a meeting with my agent and a publisher.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, I mean, I think the cynical me, the biggest problem right now is that they just care so much about people's platform and profile and how many, you know, so, you know, Instagram followers do you have and all of that.
Right.
And, you know,
which I actually have that mapped out a little bit better than most people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how many you got?
Well, I don't know how many I have, but I do have, you know, I teach a lot.
Yep.
People know me.
Do you have a list?
I have a list.
Okay.
You know, I have I have a lot of the stuff that you're supposed to have. And I do get out in front of the room a lot. I'm on different various podcasts. I do speak at addiction treatment conferences. There are people who are interested in the work that I'm doing. So I do have, I jokingly would say that even if my book sucks, I'll probably still sell 5 or 10,000 copies, you know?
Yeah.
Just because of various streams of people who are interested in things like mindfulness and Buddhism and addiction.
Okay, so here's what I have to say to you, even though you didn't ask for my opinion.
Nice.
You were so close to, if they're saying, yeah, they came to you, they said, yeah, we like it, give us more. They're not asking you to write the book. They're asking you to give them a little bit more.
Yeah, it's probably true. But you know me, I just haven't been able to follow through, and I've been so busy and so kind of ambivalent about the whole thing that once I get moved and settled, I'll probably hit it a little bit harder and give it another kind of blast. But then again, I also, I don't know. I don't feel a strong desire or a sense of urgency of this being something that I need to do. And maybe it's something that happens in 2 years from now. I don't feel like I need to get it out there right away. So maybe that's part of the reason why it hasn't happened yet is, you know, my own lack of kind of interest in the whole thing.
Right, right. I would argue that you are potentially more interested in it than you're letting your conscious mind know, that the fact that you've done 90% of the work.
Yeah,
but
that's
who knows? Well, look, we got to get close to wrapping up. I do also want to say that you now have a podcast.
I do have a podcast. I have a podcast and a website. My website is Rebel Saint Dharma, which is a pretty useful website. You can, my teaching schedule is on my website. I have some talks on my website. I have some Buddhist handouts and academic stuff and suggested reading lists. And so there's some good useful information on there. And also people who want to work with me one-on-one, one of the things I do is I do mentor students. Through FaceTime or Skype. And there's information about that. People who want to really develop and establish a regular sitting practice who haven't been able to do that can contact me through there. And of course, the podcast is also called Rebel Saint Dharma, which is on iTunes now. So you can just do an iTunes search. And mostly it has Dharma talks on it. It will have some guided meditation. So people who want to learn meditation, there'll be some really well-recorded guided meditations on there. Lots of talks and lectures on various aspects of Buddhism. And also I do want to interview people. So part of it is I want to interview some of the Buddhist teachers that I like. I haven't got that one sussed out yet, but that's something that I'm interested in trying to give people a broader appetite for practice. And mostly it's Dharma-based, Buddhism, mindfulness, not so much addiction recovery, although that tends to bleed in because that's been part of my experience.
And you are, do you ever work with people in person?
I can and will, but it's so hard.
Yeah.
And nowadays it's just so easy for people to just, you know, I used to think that one-on-one in person is so much better, but now that I've been working on Skype and FaceTime, it's like you can actually, it's really just as good as having them in the room, I think. Yeah. And it, and especially being in LA, it's like you don't have to get in the car and drive. So if people want to come, and I also don't have an office, so that makes it hard.
Yeah.
So I find that it, you know, it, Skype, FaceTime, computer, face-to-face audio is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think that you can get a lot accomplished in that capacity.
Well, this has been fabulous. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I'm just, you know, I'm moving out to Aurora, Colorado, which I'm very excited about to get out of Los Angeles. And, you know, moving ahead, mostly my interest has been and will be like teaching long-term residential retreats, doing some addiction treatment work and working more on this emotional intelligence, Atlas of Emotion stuff that I've been interested in with Eve Ekman and following that and seeing where that goes and just kind of, you know, showing up for things that I'm invited to that I'm interested in. So there, we may or may not see a book. We'll see. We'll talk about that more. But I'm curious to see what happens as I have more space for myself and more space to kind of say yes to things that I've been saying no to because I've been too busy.
Well, and Los Angeles will miss you.
Okay.
Well, so there you have it. Dave Smith here on Recover Girl. If you want to find out more about this podcast, go to recovergirlpod.com. And if you want to find out more about my coaching program for writers so that you can sell a book like Dave Smith is about to sell his second book, go to annadavidcoaching.com. Thanks for listening.